Today on the Florida Roundup, Jeb Bush defends his education reform record during a Tallahassee summit this week. Will the former governor's support for new education standards affect a possible run for the presidency? Hello, I'm Christine DiMattei, filling in for Tom Hudson this week. We'll also be discussing how the Jeb Bush camp is handling some email and Twitter snafus. Also, the new developments that might be convincing Florida lawmakers to get behind Medicaid expansion this year. Plus, researchers have new information on drug use during a popular annual Miami Music Festival. And what our End of the Road series taught us about South Florida's stretch of I-95. Join us with a panel of the area's top journalists. We'll also be getting your feedback along the way. The Florida Roundup is next. Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMattei, filling in for Tom Hudson. We'll be discussing the week that was and dig behind the news and the newsmakers making headlines. When Jeb Bush was governor of Florida, he made public education reform a major focus of his administration. Standardized testing was a big part of Bush's education policies, as were school and teacher accountability. And now, as he contemplates a run for the presidency in 2016, Bush is coming under fire for supporting the new multi-state educational standards known as Common Core. At a recent education summit, Bush defended the need for standardized testing.
I think, you know, some school districts just go nuts about this stuff, and the legislature should be reviewing these things so that the tests really do validate critical thinking skills, that there are fewer of them. But they really need to continue to be part of a robust accountability system, for sure.
Joining us in the studio now is WLRN education reporter John O'Connor. John, good to see you.
Thank you.
In the Miami Herald newsroom, Herald State Politics editor Sergio Bustos. Hi, Serge.
Hello, good afternoon.
And joining us also is S.V. Date, editor for NPR's Washington Desk and author of Jeb, America's Next Bush. S.V., an honor and a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Now, John, during that education summit, did Jeb Bush use the words Common Core anywhere in there?
Not until reporters asked him about it and why he wasn't using it. Common Core are these standards adopted by more than 40 states. They're math and language arts standards. They kind of outline what students should know at the end of every grade, but they've become a live wire, particularly for conservative Republicans, because they worry it's going to mean less local control over what's being taught in the classroom.
Okay, what specifically is involved in Common Core? I took a look at, for instance, what is necessary for language arts skills. I mean, from what I see, it's moving away from, you know, the personal narrative of what I did for my summer vacation and more into what?
It's the biggest focus is critical thinking. And the goal of the standards is that you're going to ask kids to write things, and they're going to have to use evidence provided to them to back up their arguments. So that, you know, as you said, less writing about feelings and what they're thinking, and more writing about, you know, how to persuade someone, how to, you know, what is the argument that somebody else is making, and trying to dissect that argument, finding the weaknesses in that argument, doing that with their classmates as well, working in small groups. On the math side, the focus is really on understanding the fundamental concepts that make math work, rather than just being able to solve a problem and get to the correct answer.
Oh, God, math was my worst. I feel sorry for these poor kids. I really do. Sergio, John just said that Jeb did not mention the words Common Core until reporters asked him. Why not? Why would he distance himself from those words Common Core?
Well, I think, you know, he's got a number of issues that kind of draw the ire of real conservatives within the party. And I would just suggest to you, I'll borrow a quote from George Will. When Bush first announced he was thinking of almost running, this is what George Will said about Bush. He said, quote, has four strikes against him: Common Core, immigration, his last name, and the big sign on his back that says establishment choice. And so Common Core is just one of many issues that he's going to face, and we all expect him to run, that as he prepares for this very long Republican primary.
And at the same summit, Bush had a lot to say about standardized testing.
I think if you don't measure, you don't really care. You have to assess where students are. We can have better tests. We can have fewer tests. But the tests that matter are the ones that really do assess where a kid is.
And we're going to discuss school accountability and testing in a few seconds. But SV, how important is Jeb Bush's past education record if he decides to run in 2016?
Well, that's really what he talked about most, wasn't it? When he was governor of Florida, was what he was doing for the public schools and the improvements in the test scores and so forth. What he will use, I think, to help sell this in places like Iowa, where there are a lot of very conservative voters in that primary, is say, hey, look, we introduced these tests, and one of the results we got out of the test was that the failing schools, parents there got the ability to send their kids to private schools, including religious schools, using public money. And if you support vouchers, if you support school choice, then you should support me. And I think we're already seeing that. He's mentioned that a couple of times about how school choice was a big part of what he did in Florida. He's talked about it in San Francisco. He talked about it in Detroit. So, yeah, I think he'll definitely point back to Florida and what he did in education. And, you know, when you've got $50 or $60 or $100 million to spend to get your message out, you can probably get your point across.
And for our listeners out there, if you got a question or comment for our panelists, please call in. The number to call is 800-743-WLRN. Once again, that's 800-743-9576. John O'Connor, I just saw you nodding a second ago when SV was talking about what he was talking about just half a second ago, about vouchers and such.
Yeah, if you look at kind of the successes that he can really claim, school choice is one of them. In some districts in Florida, Miami-Dade being one of them, half of kids either exercise some form of school choice through their traditional public schools, you know, they choose a magnet program or something else, or they choose a charter school, or they choose a private school through one of the scholarship programs. So, you know, the idea that you know, Jeb Bush came in saying parents want these choices for their kids, and parents have reacted, and they said, yeah, we do want these choices, and they've gone out and gotten them.
Now, among the reforms that Bush is best known for, what were the most successful?
Well, he put a focus on reading early in elementary school, so having kids reading at grade level by third grade, and that seems to have paid off. The most recent international reading test results we have show Florida fourth graders ranked second in the world. We're going to get some new results soon, hopefully, but clearly that is one success he can claim. Now, with almost everything in education, every you know, positive also has kind of a downside as well. And if you look at the results, by the time kids get to high school, Florida students aren't reading as well compared to the rest of the country and the rest of the world. So, you know, his focus on minority students has paid dividends as well. Florida has what, you know, the achievement gap, which is the difference in test performance between white students and Black or Hispanic students, is smaller than it is in a lot of other states. And that's part of the reason for the annual testing, is so that schools have to focus on the results of minority kids, poor kids, or the lowest performing kids. And Jeb Bush really put a focus on that.
Okay. So among his reforms that he's best known for, which were the most unsuccessful?
Well, I mean, we don't know how well certain things work. The private school scholarships, there's mixed data on that as to whether kids actually perform better if they go to a private school. You know, the defenders of the private school program say, well, parents, you know, are sending their kids here, and you know, they're happier with this choice, and so we think that that's a positive, even if we don't know from test results whether or not they're actually performing better.
Okay. SV, there were certain business ties that Jeb Bush had to certain major players in education, like testing software companies, education tech companies. How badly could that come back to haunt him?
Well, to be honest, I don't think that's going to be a big problem for him. I think his involvement with big banks like Barclay and Lehman Brothers and some of the private equity things he did, that might be a little bit more difficult for him to explain in the context of a general election, or and maybe even among the populists in the Republican primaries. But looking back at his history from the time he came to Miami in the early 1980s, going all the way forward, I mean, he had a plan, and his plan was to run for governor after he'd made a certain amount of money. And he set about doing that. And then it didn't really matter necessarily what type of business it was. He wanted to get a nest egg so he can get into public service. So he kind of did that again after the end of his governorship. And it'd be one thing if he was in it to make money for the sake of making money. And I don't know that's you can really make that argument about Governor Bush. There are a lot of things you can say about him, but I don't think he's been in it just to get rich.
And here's a question for all three of our panelists, anyone who wants to just jump in. In anyone's assessment, what among his policies when he was governor translate well or will not translate well on a national platform? Sergio?
I still think the education one is going to translate well, despite some controversy with him. But again, I think people view him as someone willing to change the culture of the country in terms of education and taking on such a delicate issue. But again, it's an issue that affects a whole lot of people and the future of the country itself. And I think the fact that he made attempts, I think, will play favorably, despite the, protests from Common Core, the testing folks, teachers, and the like. But again, I think overall it could play well for him.
Okay.
I think that, if I may, his competence in handling the hurricanes of 2004 and 2005, I think that will be something you can point to. Say, look, I get into the details when that's important, and I look at the big picture when that's important, and you can count on me to get the basics and get the important things right. So just a simple level of competence, I think, in doing such things as emergency management will probably be a big thing that he can point back to in Florida for him.
Okay. And we've got a question from Manuel in Fort Lauderdale. He's got a question about public schools and religious schools. Manuel, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm concerned with two aspects of taking money out of public schools to religious schools. As a taxpayer, I don't expect my money to be used in a religious manner. And also, the more you take out of public schools to private schools, then there won't be any money left over in public schools to do that job.
Okay, thank you.
I'll leave out of here.
Thank you, Manuel. Taking public schools, John, taking money out of public schools for religious schools?
Well, we
Can
have
you
a,
address that?
We have a court case going on right now that's trying to figure out if that's actually what's happening. That's kind of the crux of the argument. The Florida Education Association, which is the largest teachers union, has challenged the tax credit scholarship program, arguing that, in fact, it creates a separate private school system funded by essentially diverted public dollars. And so what the court, one of the things the judge at a recent hearing was trying to figure out was, is this actually public money that's being diverted for another purpose, or is it not public money? And so that's one of the things we're going to hear from this court case.
And we've also got a question or a comment from Jerry in South Miami. Jerry, you're on the air.
Over some of the stuff from Bush when he was governor, his objective all along was to starve the public school systems of the money they needed, make the public schools look bad to justify having private schools, especially for-profit charter schools. We had to go out and get signatures on petitions. We passed a small class size amendment, and he said, as he campaigned against it, this passes, I have devious ways of getting around it, and he did. He's getting too much of a pass on this stuff. He has no interest in good public school systems at all. He wants people to be able to make money. We see it right here in Dade County with these charters where the people behind them are making millions of dollars.
Okay.
And
okay,
it's pretty bad, really.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you for your comment. Class size restrictions. He's not in favor, am I correct?
No, he mentioned this the other day at his education summit. He predicted doom and gloom for the state budget when the class size amendment passed, and that just didn't materialize. And of course, you're talking about funding for schools too. And during his time in office, the economy in Florida was great, and so there was an increase in education funding. And so, one of the criticisms of Jeb Bush's successes as governor, education-related successes, is that in fact it's due to the amount of money that was flowing into public schools through the good economy.
And you just mentioned John doom and gloom. I've got another double O here. Oops. Let's switching gears a second. Jeb Bush's potential presidential campaign off to a little bit of a rocky start, at least in the cyber world. This week, Jeb Bush had to fire his chief technology officer after reporters uncovered some insensitive tweets that the tech guru made about women, about gays, and about African Americans. Now, it's important to note that this was a few years ago before he was working for Bush. But on top of that, Jeb Bush accidentally published about 275,000 emails from his time as Florida governor, with several Floridians' personal information included in those. They include social security numbers and email addresses. Oopsie. Bush told reporters in Tallahassee that it was the job of the state of Florida, actually, to redact that sensitive information.
That was a matter of public record in the Department of State. So we just released what the government gave us. If we have private information that's out there, we're going to take it off for sure.
Sergio, why did Bush publish those emails in the first place?
Well, he wants to be transparent, and frankly, all these emails have been out before. Now they've, in light of this likely run for president, he's tried to be more transparent and show everything to everyone. Unfortunately, in this case, it's not a small number of people. It's about 12,000 people whose IDs. Social Security numbers have been exposed, and in this day and age of identity fraud, I think it's bigger than a little oops. Will it affect them long run? Probably not. But it's the kind of thing you don't want to draw headlines when you're trying to run for the White House.
Now, SV, you covered Jeb's time in office when you were Tallahassee bureau chief for the Palm Beach Post.
Right.
Was he any more tech savvy back then, between '98 and 2007?
Well, absolutely. He was, he was walk around with his BlackBerry everywhere he went back when BlackBerries were brand new. And he would be writing emails to everyone at all times of day and night, receiving them and so on. So, this is getting on Twitter and getting on Facebook. All that, these are tools, and tools can be purchased. And especially when you have the kind of money that he's going to have, it's not the best thing to have a chief technology person to be fired so quickly. But then on the other hand, it's February, and there's a lot of time ahead. As to the emails, I can't help but note the irony here that Governor Bush was not a big fan of transparency when he was actually governor. He put up a lot of barriers to getting public records requests filled. And so now all of a sudden he's putting out all these, he's posting, he's not really releasing, he's posting, because the emails are a matter of public record, as Sergio pointed out. And they have been available from the Department of State and NPR, as well as many other entities, requested them and have them in full. What he did was merely put that stuff directly online, assuming that the Department of State had done its job of redacting things like Social Security numbers. That was probably an oversight on the governor's part.
Okay, and John and I were talking about this just yesterday, that this is kind of a cautionary tale. At first we said for anybody embarking on a tech career, but we decided for anybody embarking on any career, watch what you tweet. Nespa?
I totally agree. I'm glad Twitter and Facebook didn't exist when I was in college, at least to the extent that they do now, because, who knows what future employer might find in my history that would come back to bite me.
Yep. We need to take a short break. Still to come, could 2015 be the year that Florida expands Medicaid? That's just ahead on the Florida Roundup. I'm Christine DiMatte. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. For the past 2 years, Florida's Republican-led legislature has rejected federal funds to expand Medicaid. This despite business and healthcare groups stating strenuously that they need the funds. The money could help business owners avoid fines for not offering coverage to employees and provide health services to needy families. Now, most recently, two influential business groups have joined in support of using the funds to save costs. One of them is the Associated Industries of Florida Business Lobby. And those in the legislature who once opposed accepting money are thinking a little differently now that 2015 has rolled around. Republican State Senator Anna Terry Flores of Miami says the time has come.
And what's interesting is that you have the buy-in from the business community, from private sector, from your non-traditional supporters, mm-hmm. of government funding.
and U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell is also taking note of the fact that business groups and a handful of Republican governors are endorsing Medicaid expansion.
What we see across the country is that because of the economic impact of the expansion, that's something that the business community across the country, and whether that's in Indiana, where recently Governor Pence and I had the opportunity to spend time together and come to an agreement, we see broad support from the business community, and that's because of the economic impact it has, both for the individuals in terms of their healthiness and their productivity, but overall, especially in the hospitals, in terms of their economics and having care that's paid for.
And here with us to talk about the latest in Florida health care is Daniel Chang, Miami Herald reporter. He's on the line from the Miami Herald newsroom. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Chris.
And also Mary Shedden, health editor at our sister station WUSF in Tampa. Hi, Mary.
How are you doing?
Now, Dan, let's review a little Medicaid expansion 101 and perhaps clear up some misperceptions. Medicaid is health care coverage, a coverage program intended for those with low income, but low income is not the only requirement. Am I correct?
Well, yes, in Florida, every state will have a different set of rules and eligibility standards for Medicaid. In Florida, you have to be really poor at about 30% of the federal poverty level. And you also have to have a dependent child or be disabled or be a child yourself. So most adults in the state of Florida who would qualify, perhaps who are below the federal poverty level and are single, a lot of them aren't getting covered because we haven't expanded Medicaid eligibility as it was envisioned under the Affordable Care Act.
Okay, and Mary, for those who do favor expanding Medicaid in Florida, what are the arguments for expanding it?
Well, the main argument, especially from the business community, is that somebody is paying for this health care, the people who are going to the hospital that can't afford it. Somebody's paying it, and they're saying that money is being spilled into the cost of our health insurance for those who may have an employer-based plan, or they're seeing the costs spread out elsewhere. And I think that one of the major arguments is that it's being spent somewhere, so why don't we team up and work with the federal government to have a program where we can spread the burden, the financial burden, a little broader.
Okay. Now, just a second ago, we mentioned at least one influential business group, Associated Industries of Florida. Who are they? What are they about?
The Associated Industries is one of the largest business groups. They and the Florida Chamber of Commerce, they really promote the pro-growth business industry, both in Tallahassee and statewide. They've actually come up with a specific proposal called A Healthy Florida Works, and they are being very careful to avoid the term Medicaid or Medicaid expansion. They are calling it a free market approach to helping low-income individuals have health insurance in the state of Florida. And that's gotten a lot of support for the arguments that I mentioned earlier.
And what are the internal workings of Healthy Florida Works?
It's got a lot of the aspects that the Medicaid expansion other states are doing, where it's you are paying a monthly premium based on a sliding scale. So your income determines how much you would pay for your monthly health insurance premium. But the difference in this this plan is that you would have to prove that you have a job or that you're looking for work or that you're enrolled in school. There's a level of accountability. The other issue is that the government steps out and private insurance companies are really managing the plan.
And I've just gotten a little note that we have lost our signal to Dan Chang. So, Mary, you're going to be ruling the roost for a while.
Wait,
okay?
Chris, I think I'm back.
Oh, Dan's back. Welcome
Sorry
back,
about
Dan.
That.
Quite all right. Glad to have you back again. Now, this is a question for the both of you, as long as you're both with me. Why all of a sudden are hearts and minds changing about Medicaid?
Well, I could take a crack at that.
Please do.
All right. Well, I think part of the reason is that Florida is facing the loss of this special pot of money called the low-income pool. That's one of the reasons. And what the low-income pool really does is that it helps hospitals that treat large numbers of Medicaid patients and the uninsured to recover those costs, the costs that Mary was explaining earlier that we all, to some degree, bear, especially when there are more uninsured. So that money that the state receives in matching dollars from the federal government is supposed to run out on June 30th, although they're negotiating currently, the state and the government, a successor plan that would help hospitals do that, because Medicaid expansion alone is not going to be enough. Medicaid often underpays hospitals. That's what all the hospitals say. And
okay, Dan, let me interrupt you a second. You just said they're working on it. Who's working on it, getting
that
hospitals?
That would be the Agency for Healthcare Administration, which is our state agency, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the federal regulatory agency that oversees Medicaid. So the federal government and our state government officials are currently meeting and working on a plan for a different type of program, one that perhaps is more accountable and transparent than the current system that we have now. So that money going away is going to be a big motivator for the state, because otherwise it would have to tap into its general funds. Yep. You know, the governor's plan for tax breaks might not be able to come through. So.
And that money going away has been a huge deal this week. Mary, correct me if I'm wrong. Doesn't this not throw a wrench in the works of Governor Rick Scott's projected budget?
Indeed. The low-income pool money that Dan was talking about is part of Governor Scott's budget for the coming year. And so this really is forcing the hand of legislators to talk about what are we going to do if this source of money is not there. The reason the low-income pool funds are going away is because the Affordable Care Act was designed to replace these kind of funds. And that's not happening in the way the federal government envisioned here in Florida. And so these are the tough questions, and I think it's forcing the hand of legislators a little more in this session than, say, in the previous two, when they've just strictly been in opposition to accepting federal funds, because bluntly, I think they don't trust the federal government to hold their side of the bargain, which is to pay 100% of Medicaid expansion funds for 3 years and then 90% after that.
The irony is that it's written into the Affordable Care Act that the federal government will and must pay those funds. So in order for the federal government to renege on its promise, it would probably require an act of Congress. So I wonder about that argument from the Republicans personally.
But was not anyone forewarned about this earlier? Why does this all of a sudden come out of the blue?
Well, they've known about it for a year. The state has, and the federal government. I don't think it's necessarily coming out of the blue, Chris. I think that, you know, I've talked to folks at Miami-Dade's large public hospital, which is Jackson Health System or Jackson mm-hmm. Memorial Hospital, and they say that, you know, they're talking to state officials about trying to find alternative methods or an alternative program. And they cite other states where the federal government has approved LIP programs, but those are in states that have accepted Medicaid expansion, like New York and California. And Florida would really be the first state without Medicaid expansion to have a LIP program continue, again, without expansion.
And this is a question for the both of you. In brief, if Medicaid is not expanded in Florida, how many poor people are going to be left without coverage?
Well, the current estimate is anywhere between 750,000 and 1 million. In Miami-Dade, I believe the count is about 160,000, 170,000 people.
Okay.
And I think, and one interesting thing to mention is hospitals can't turn away people who don't have health coverage.
Right.
And so the care, the treatment can be there, but the money problem will persist.
Okay. And whenever we discuss anything about health care and health insurance coverage, we often talk about the so-called young invincibles. These are the 20-somethings who don't make getting health care a priority because, you know, hey, they're young. Plenty of time to worry about it later. And that sense of invulnerability to harm, that's one of the best things about being young, but sadly, it often leads to some reckless behavior. Each year, the electronic music festival called Ultra brings thousands of visitors to Miami. And if you ask some people who live in the vicinity of Bayfront Park where the festival is held, they'll tell you the event also brings noise and traffic and, well, here's a man who lived across the street during the 2013 Ultra. Let's let him tell it.
Bunch of f***ing lights and noises and crazy people on drugs and girls with their asses hanging out their shorts and guys with the muscles and the steroids and the mollies and the ecstasies and the...
Just love that guy. But, you know, all kidding aside, included in that observation was the mention of Molly and ecstasy. These are two street drugs. Serious business, grave enough to get the attention of researchers documenting drug use among the attendees of Ultra. And here to help us unpack those figures and to get some insight into what Ultra means to the city of Miami is David Smiley. He covers the city of Miami for the Miami Herald.
Hi, thanks for having
David.
Me.
So these researchers, why did they study ULTRA in the first place?
Well, the point of the study was, according to the researchers, to get a better grasp of what kinds of designer drugs are being used right now and on the electronic music scene. So they're saying that they were trying to get a better sense of what is a very, you know, very quickly evolving drug culture, and to be able to better educate the users and in law enforcement.
You know, the term designer drugs, it always makes me, it evokes images of, you know, the labels on the back of one's blue jeans. What do we mean by designer drugs?
We're talking about synthetic substances, so we're not talking about pot or organically grown chemicals. We're talking about things that are manufactured in labs for consumption and intoxication.
Now, this study, once again, who did it?
This was done by the Center for Forensic Science Research and Education. They're a Pennsylvania-based forensics center that furthers training and strategies for scientists and for law enforcement.
And how was that study funded? By whom?
The National Institute of Justice, which is an arm of the Department of Justice, gave a $225,000 grant in 2013 to fund this study.
Okay. And who was it who commissioned it? Why was it done?
I couldn't tell you specifically who, but the researchers here who I spoke to Barry Logan, who's a toxicologist from the center, and they're looking at expanding these efforts to other festivals, but he said that he happened to be in Miami one year during ULTRA, I think in 2012 or 2013, and he thought it would be a good idea to come back and station up outside the festival. I guess they couldn't get inside, but they posted up outside Bayfront Park, and they surveyed people who had tickets and were going into ULTRA to get a better sense of what kind of drugs they have used and might be using.
Okay, so to be clear, because there have been concerns about ULTRA expressed by civic leaders, this was not commissioned by any Miami or Miami-Dade civic leaders, right?
No, yeah, this wasn't started by anyone in the city of Miami.
Okay, and so how did they collect their data? This is
so
odd.
This is actually what got me interested.
Did they hand people cups on the way out of the festival?
the idea, when I learned that they were not only taking surveys, but they also received urine and blood samples, that's actually what got me interested. I don't think anyone would be surprised at all by a study that says that a majority of the attendees at ULTRA, or really any sort of music festival in general, might be on some kind of intoxicant. I think, you know, that's the general assumption. But what they did is the researchers posted up outside Bayfront Park, and they, in exchange for $20 Dunkin' Donut gift cards, they spoke to
how
people.
Much?
$20.
What a deal.
Yeah. so they spoke to the attendees, and they asked them questions about, you know, what kind of drugs have you used during the past week? And then for some who willingly were okay with going beyond that, there were 104 out of 145 participants who gave urine samples, and there were 38 who gave blood samples. And so the researchers used these samples to actually physically prove what drugs were in these attendees' systems. Apparently, the first day they didn't ask for tickets. They sort of gauged based on honesty and appearance. But they actually did run into an issue where the homeless were coming and claiming they were going to ULTRA. I think they realized at that point that they had to start asking for tickets in days two and three. So, you know, there is a little bit of a reason to question, these aren't people who are inside ULTRA. At least for day one, you know, whether their data is a little fuzzy.
Okay, we're going to just reach out to our listeners for half a second and ask you to call in if you have a question or a comment. The number to call is 800-743-9576. And, you know, David, safety has always been a concern with any sort of music festival, I suppose. And the issue was brought into very, very sharp focus last year. A security guard was seriously injured after she was trampled by fans trying to get into ULTRA. And Miami Commissioner Mark Sarnoff had this to say last year when the commission had to vote whether or not to keep this festival in downtown Miami.
A young lady was crushed under the boots of those who had no care whatsoever for human life when they literally stood on top of her simply because she was in the way.
Okay, what changed with ULTRA after that vote was taken?
Well, this year they're coming back as an 18 and older event.
They are,
which is
okay.
A change. I think that would be the largest change. They're also, they seem to be aggressively advertising that a zero tolerance for drugs. You know, obviously, people who are bringing in drugs are sneaking them in. They're not welcoming them in with open arms. They actually have what they call amnesty boxes, where they try to encourage people to discard their illegal drugs, no questions asked, before coming into the festival. They also hired former Miami Beach Police Chief Ray Martinez, who before going to the beach, was a longtime veteran Miami police officer who has a lot of connections in the city of Miami, and so now Martinez is their chief of security, and so I think that's an obvious sign that they are trying to bridge relations with the Miami Police Department, whose rank and file have kind of had their own testy relationship with the festival, calling for more off-duty police officers to police the event and deal with things. Primarily you're talking about issues of drug consumption.
Right. Let's go back to that study for half a second. When I read your piece, I was struck by the fact that the executive director of the researchers, of the research group, said that this data might not be reliable.
He was saying, the mayor wanted to take this snapshot. We're talking about 145 participants when there are roughly 160,000 tickets sold or comped for a three-day festival. So we're talking about a tenth of a percentage, potentially, of the tickets sold. It was the sample size for the study. So the mayor is saying this is a concerning number, where you have 104 people giving urine samples and 80% show up positive for synthetic drugs like Molly, ecstasy, and alpha PVP, which is a drug that caused one ultra attendee to die last year. He was found dead mm-hmm. in a car, and the cause was an overdose. And the mayor is saying, these are concerning numbers. 80% is a concerning number. This is why, I oppose ultra. This is why ultra should not be held in downtown Miami. But the executive director of the center is saying you can't take 0.1% of the tickets and say this is representative of the people who are attending Ultra. What we can say, according to him, is that these are the types of drugs that are being consumed by people who are going to Ultra. That we know that these are the drugs that are sort of on the market.
Okay, and once again, for the uninitiated, how much economic impact does Ultra bring in?
I don't know those numbers off the top of my head. I mean, I can tell you that they grossed like $18.5 million in ticket sales alone last year. But Ultra commissioned a study a couple of years ago that showed that they have a fairly significant economic impact on the city of Miami. Not to mention, it makes it it sort of puts Miami in the center of the electronic dance music scene. Every year when they hold this event, so.
Miami Herald reporter David Smiley. David, thank you very much.
Thanks.
And thanks also to Mary Shedden and Daniel Chang, who spoke to us a second ago about healthcare. Still to come, we share our favorite driveway moments from a series all about I-95. We will be right back. I'm Christine DiMatte. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. When you think of I-95, what goes through your mind? Something like this? This is courtesy of the late George Carlin.
Have you ever noticed when you're driving that anyone who's driving slower than you is an idiot? And anyone driving faster than you is a maniac?
Say, look at this idiot here. Will you just look at this idiot just creeping along? Whoa, look at that maniac go!
Okay, forget just a second about who you share your daily commute with. Turns out the final 87 miles of Interstate 95, the South Florida stretch, has plenty of stories to tell. And bringing them to you has been the year-long mission of reporter Kenny Malone with WLRN's End of the Road series. Now, Monday morning at 9 a.m., Kenny will host a one-hour special on real and perceived dangers on I-95. Kenny is joining us in the studio right now to talk about some of the things he's learned through that End of the Road series. Kenny Malone, welcome.
Thanks, Chris.
Now, you've driven with me, Kenny. I've been behind the driver's seat, and would you
right.
characterize me as an idiot driver or a maniac driver?
Which one was the slow one? That was the idiot.
Okay. I mean, you said it, not me.
Oh, come on, man.
No, Christine DiMattei is a very good driver. In fact, the first story that we did in this series was profiling your commute to work, which at the end you described as being more exhausting than a day's worth of work.
Yeah,
and
I have to say,
this is you commute from Broward County to our downtown offices, and it's I-95 most of the way. Yeah, it's horrible. I don't envy you at all.
Now, what are some of the most surprising discoveries you made when you were doing this series?
Well, you know, one of the things that we ended up doing a lot of stories about were the express lanes. I call them the new express lanes often, but they've been around for about 8 years now. But the express lane system is an interesting case study for us because it was an experimental solution for Florida, a pretty new idea where you try and get traffic moving quickly by keeping two lanes moving all the time,
right,
and hopefully keeping the rest moving. It was an idea that was like the alternative was a second story to the highway, so this was much cheaper. And there were a lot of surprising things that we found out about that express lane system. For example, the fact that they have to replace those poles about 8 times a year.
I was going to ask you about that. I see people running over those poles all the time.
This is called lane diving.
Lane diving.
Yep, it's illegal. Doesn't seem to deter anybody. and those poles take an unbelievable beating. We tracked down some of the stats on that stuff. It's about $1 million a year to keep those things up. So it's a serious thing. You know, the other interesting things that we found out about those express lanes is there's a phenomenon where people are actually drawn to the express lanes when the price goes up to a certain point. We still kind of don't know where that price is, but it's a phenomenon that's been observed by an economist out of Wisconsin, and we're seeing it here. So they had to raise the price as the cap for how high that stuff could go.
Now, you've done other series reporting before, but a year ago, what made you decide on End of the Road? Why was this little stretch of Interstate 95 so intriguing to you?
You'll see our stretch of I-95 pop up in a lot of studies. It, at least as of the last national numbers, was the busiest stretch of highway in the entire state of Florida, basically the busiest stretch of highway east of Chicago. California is its own world. But yeah, it's a very busy stretch of highway. Often shows up in studies about danger on the highway, about accidents. And plus, I moved here from a place where I grew up driving on the scariest highway I had to learn to drive on was two lanes, right? And so the idea that not only is this a highway that people have to learn to drive on, but it becomes a sort of main street for a lot of people, like that's the thing you either take to work or you avoid taking to work. But it's an artery in all of our lives, one way or the other. It just occurred to me that there are not just stories about the highway, but also about how it affects our life, how we interact with it.
Okay, on a scale of 1 to 10 in this last year, how much of an expert would you characterize yourself on I-95?
I mean,
on a scale of 1 to 10.
12. No, you know
everything there is to know.
It's
about
one of those things where it's like you learn shockingly how little you know about the things that we interact with all the time. Roads are part of all of our lives. And I think all of us who have a car think we're transportation experts to some extent. I certainly was that way. And I think, if anything, I've realized I am far less of an expert than I thought I was.
Okay, we want to hear from our listeners. If you've got a question, something that's always bugged you about I-95, you just got to get answered by our expert, Kenny Malone. Please call in. The number to call is 800-743-9576.
Oh, this is good. We can do like I-95 advice.
Like Dear Abby for I-95.
It'll be like Frasier for transportation.
But there were a couple of really, really poignant stories. And some that were just really, really funny. One of them involved a couple called the Robertsons.
Yeah.
What happened with the Robertsons?
Neil and Alice Robertson are two have been around South Florida for about 30 years now. Alice Robertson actually is head of the Miami Downtown Development Authority. Was doing a separate interview, and Alice, at the end of it, sort of mic was off, she said, by the way, I had a gun pulled on me once on I-95, and I was like, whoa, you need to tell me that story. And so I think we have a clip of, she was with her husband. This was back in the 80s or 90s, so you can go ahead and play a little bit of that.
And I'm probably not paying as close attention as I should because I'm getting chewed out for being late. And after I pulled on this, I get this loud horn honk. I think I probably cut this guy off.
I don't think we did.
And that's when he comes roaring up alongside us.
So it was on my side of the car, and he pulled alongside of there.
And I think Alice said something that made me look at him.
I said, oh my God, he's got a gun.
And I look over past her. She's to my right.
I ducked.
And I see this gun.
Pointed at us.
First thought in my mind was, holy what the heck?
You know, what's funny is that they tell this story all the time, but they don't. The reason that they ultimately tell it is because they're fighting because they're running late to a wedding. They get to the wedding, no one's there because they're brand new to Miami. They didn't really realize that you're supposed to show up like 30 minutes late to a wedding. So the wedding hadn't even started, and they got a gun pulled on them as a result. Well, not as a result, but part of it. So, but I think that's a good example of how 95 becomes just this setting for us. You know, it makes total sense to have one of your main go-to party stories just be an I-95 story. And that was one of the things we set out to do, was to both document the sort of the news of I-95, but also just the cultural influence of it too.
And, you know, what struck me about the Robertson story is, I think I read correctly that this, they said this happened in either the 70s or the 80s, that they didn't even know the decade.
Yeah, they can't remember. This is all kinds of details they can't remember, except they remember there was a gun and they were fighting. That's about the two things they agree on.
Speaking of the 70s, back then, I-95 at one point was dubbed the Reefer Express.
Reefer Express.
Tell us
right.
about that.
This is a great book by a reporter at NBC named Tony DeCopel. His dad, it turns out, was a major pot smuggler back then. He had no idea, but Tony was living down here. And I interviewed Tony about his book, specifically about the I-95 connections. His dad was, you know, part of this big pot smuggling ring. But, you know, virtually all of the pot that was coming into the United States at that time was coming in through Florida, and ergo straight up I-95. I asked Tony, he calls Florida the bong, the proverbial bong, and he said that makes I-95 sort of the pipe of the bong. It was a crucial part of inhaling weed into the United States.
And here's what DeCopel said.
You couldn't get high in America without touching something that had traveled on that particular stretch of asphalt. So many people were driving dope up I-95 that it began to be talked about as the Reefer Express. And so many of those people who were driving the dope were doing cocaine, and a lot of cocaine, that they started describing their lines as lines as long as I-95.
Lines as long as I-95.
You know, this is so funny, Kenny. We were talking healthcare, we were talking education, and not many phone calls. We talk about I-95, and all of a sudden the phones are lighting up like
Ooh,
a
nice.
Christmas tree. We've got Ken in Fort Lauderdale, and he's got a question about something that intrigues me. I'm going to do my own soundbite here. Ken, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I have a question about when they're going to be doing the paving on I-95. It seems like it's been different levels, and there's so many patches all over the place on that road for the past 10 years. Every time I drive to Miami for an event on a motorcycle, I hit a bump and I'm in the next lane.
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting thing. You say you have a motorcycle?
Yes, it's horrible on that road.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm not the only one, obviously, ride down the road on a motorcycle. But even in a car, you can hit a bump and end up in the next lane.
Yeah, the bumpy roads actually became a whole portion of our coverage. One of my bosses actually complained to me about it, and I was like, ah, come on, this is just a boss complaint. But I went out, and it is bumpy, and B, lots of people have been complaining about this. The short answer is that the stretch of I-95, much of the stretch of I-95 in Miami-Dade County is concrete instead of asphalt. We're used to asphalt repaving, where it's
correct.
Sort of all done very casually. So what they have to do with the concrete is take big chunks out, replace the chunk, you put a little too much concrete in, and then you kind of grind it down. That process, they call it concrete rehabilitation. I believe it will be going on until 2017 in various ways. Now they're working on the northbound section right now, and I think the new contractor is doing it in a way that is a little less bumpy, based on the conversations I've had with FDOT, but I would not expect that to go away anytime soon.
Okay, and speaking of going away, gotta ask you, Ken, are you gonna miss End of the Road?
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. The one thing I won't miss are all of the fact-checking drives that I've had to do on I-95 at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, trying to go see details. But yeah, no, it has been very interesting to become the guy at the party who can answer almost every question to some extent about Interstate 95. And I've grown to have this very strange affection for this piece of concrete and this giant stretch of asphalt.
And on Monday, we're going to give the I-95 series the send-off it deserves with our hour-long End of the Road special. You can listen to that at 9 a.m. on Monday, and also a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. Monday night. That will be hosted by the driving force, pun intended,
yes,
of the End of the Road series, our own Kenny Malone. Kenny, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks. And make sure to check out the web elements for that, too. It's going to be great.
That's all the time we have for today's Florida Roundup, and we would like to thank all our guests, Sergio Bustos, John O'Connor, S.V. Date from NPR's Washington desk, Daniel Chang, Mary Shedden, David Smiley, Kenny Malone. We've already thanked you, Kenny. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen to it again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. We will also post it on our website at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Alicia Zuckerman and Julia Duba. Our news director is Taryn Shepard. Our digital editor is Maria Muriel. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Mayers. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. I'm Christine DiMatte. Thanks for listening.